Reading from the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Canto 2, Text 1, Verse 14. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Vaikuntham Dulabham Muktai Sandrananda Chiratmakam Nishkamaye Tutad Bhakta Labhante Sadhya Evatat. That abode, Vaikuntha, is made of concentrated ecstasy and pure consciousness. Even for liberated souls, it is difficult to attain. But the Lord's devotees, who are free from selfish desires, reach it at once. Commentary. Mother Uttara is made of concentrated... Wait. Mother Uttara now tells her son Parikshit what she understands about the transcendental nature of Vaikuntha. Parikshit had heard similar descriptions of the Vaikuntha atmosphere from Sukadeva Goswami in the second and tenth cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakrunmulatam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Sri Chaitanya Mano Vairagya Bhakti Risham Priyatnai Apayamam Manabhipsamandam Kapamburaya Paraduka Duki Sanatanastam Prabhamastriyami Vansha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Shindu Bhayevacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasade Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Now, technically, I'm supposed to have the controls so that I can mute the phone. But it doesn't seem to be working here. So I ask everyone there to please mute your phone, because these are really deep subjects now. And it's going to be difficult for me to do it. Yes, go ahead.
It said the phone was muted when I called in. It said it was muted.
Really?
Like, yeah, automatically. At least mine did, so maybe
okay.
You did it.
I'm hearing people. That's fine.
Us, we called in. We had to mute it ourselves.
Okay.
So, anyway.
Let me try.
Okay, let's see if that works now. So, very short context, because I realize that the, we do have a pretty steady audience here. But even myself, I need to kind of be refreshed. And really, it's Uttara, she's speaking. And she's heard about the topmost devotees. And now she wants to get an exposition from her son, Lodge Prickett, who's kind of instructing her in the last days of his life on the essence of what he had just heard from Sukadeva Goswami. So we're getting really the essence of the Bhagavatam. And the essence of the Bhagavatam, it's the gradations of depth in one's relationship with Krishna. That's going to be discussed here, that it's all perfect because it's all a pure mood of service, but there are different moods of devotion that cause different gradations. And with moods of devotion that cause different gradations, there are places of devotion that facilitate greater depths of relationship and intimacy. So now we're up to the point where Uttara is inquiring about that. He's inquiring about the places. And as the first canto of the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, we'll call that for whatever, I don't have any better term, gave a systematic gradation of levels of devotion, this canto will give systematic gradations of places of devotion. And they're so intimately related that they're really explaining the same thing, which is, there's really, basically, in Gaudiya Vaishnava theology, there's actually one thing that exists, really. I mean, there's God and his energies, and God and his devotees, and the mutual love between them. That's reality uncovered. But in that mutual love between the devotees and God in its variegated ways and the different expressions of that love, there are also places which are so intimately connected with that love and inspire it. And they're very important to know because according to the devotion that you are aspiring for, there's a different place to facilitate it. I'm just thinking now in a personal way in my own spiritual life, how important just the place of Vrindavan is. A lot of people that are here now, it's very, very quiet in Vrindavan, and the weather is sublime. I'm right now just in a t-shirt in my room, and it's quarter after, but it's a little cool, but very comfortable. And maybe it's a time, you know, as it's getting a little cooler, where the pilgrim aspect of people coming here for a short time is over, maybe more like the residents are here. And after that intense activity and social atmosphere of Kartik, you know, people start to go internal. And it's just a very, very sublime atmosphere. I don't know how many people that are here that are supposed to go to other places are not. And from, you know, the more advanced devotees to the, well, let's say more advanced, but the more senior to the less senior, I don't know how many people are telling me, I just don't want to leave this place. And I'm also kind of noting, this is my own perception, because I've never had that experience, that there's some type of maturity here. I don't know, because somehow with institutions and Vrindavan and the intensity, I've been here for so many years, and it's always with, you know, covering that sweetness with some controversy or polemics or power struggle or political. It doesn't seem to be here. It just seems to be what Krishna consciousness should be. Just Vaishnava is dedicated on deepening their depth of understanding in bhakti and the holy name. But it really, really highlights the place. As Jiva Goswami said, bhakti is not difficult. I think But what's difficult is with avoiding offenses. Narada Bhakti Sutra, it says that's what bhakti is, removing the obstacles to atmarati, removing the obstacles to that pure love and devotion which is situated in one's heart. And you remove the offenses, and it begins to shine. I just feel that about here, but really, it's the place, and it's so mystical, especially at this time where you don't have a real imported culture to kind of skew your vision of it. Imported culture means people who don't live here, they come, they execute devotional service, it's fine. But people who live here and just... And now that Indradyumna Swami and Giriraj Swami and Bibi Govinda Swami and Bhojan Prabhu just left, but people are staying longer. It's just such a sweetness. Anyway, she really wants to find out about the place, and she's inquiring from her teacher. And as a good student, of course, it's her son, but her son is taking that position. But as a good student, she's laying out to her teacher the context and frame of reference by which she is presently understanding the subject. That actually helps the teacher. Otherwise, the teacher is going to say things, communicate things, which the student doesn't have a frame of reference for, and will soon discover that, by the questions the student asks. And that dialectic will go on until the truth that the teacher is speaking is understood by the student. So that frame of reference is sufficiently enough mature to understand it. But she's laying it really out very, very clearly and very directly. She really wants to understand the place that deserves the type of devotion that she heard about when Krishna had finally, Narada in Maharaj Prickett's exposition, when Narada had finally found the topmost devotees in that description is there. So what she's doing to establish her own question and frame of reference is showing and demonstrating the relationship between one's consciousness and the destination one achieves. Beginning with the materially attached who are performing prescribed duties, to those who are renounced and performing prescribed duties, who have an inclination to go further but need to be purified. What's clear is everyone needs to become detached. How you do it, is maybe of a different nature, but ultimately one has to become detached because it is one's attachments that anchor one here in the world. Our consciousness is somehow or other reflected on a particular field of activities called the body to fulfill our desire to to have an experience of self-centeredness rather than service. Somehow the consciousness has been reflected. We desire, and God facilitates our desire, and this is how He facilitates our desire. When you want to not be what we are, which is basically a devotee, a part of God, for the function of service, complete service, because the hand exists only for the body. We exist for God. And by doing that, we fulfill our own existence, which is to serve God, because that's what we are by constitution. We're particle of consciousness. We're infinitesimal, but I think we're very significant. Significant in the sense that we're part of God. And how significant is that? If you just think what your intrinsic internal nature is you're of God, you're part of God. It's just something special. We just need to embrace that. We need to embrace the glory of what we are, which is God, part of Him. It's a spiritual component of God, of reality. But somehow or other, the consciousness being reflected we become something else. We become distorted. And that takes a lot of effort, because an artificial position it takes much more to keep up than a natural position. It's just like water. I'm going to finish this train of thought, but I lost the train of thought relationship to the verse, and I'll get back to that, but I'll finish this thought anyway. I don't know why that sometimes happens, but I love the example Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He called it Swabhav Nisarg. Swabhav is your own nature. Nisarg is your acquired nature. And he gives a beautiful analogy, and even though I'm not sure how it's connected here, I want to explain it because it's really significant. What he explains is it's like water. H2O, its nature is liquidity. By certain conditions, it becomes ice. And there's some kind of condition that holds up the ice. And therefore, the liquidity which is inherent in the ice is not manifest. And therefore, you have to change the environment, you have to change the conditions, and then it reverts to what it is. But it's harder to maintain ice than water, at least in a normal environment. It's harder to maintain ice than water. It's some effort to keep it up. So in the same way, somehow or other, this artificial identity has been assumed. Anyway, I have to get back to Uttara and try to get some continuity. Anyway, she's presenting that context and then it was described that naturally, I remember the point. So what keeps one here in the world is our attachments. And attachments mean attachment to something else than what we are. that reflects the consciousness on the body, the attachment to some kind of self-centered enjoy control. It's somehow key, and as long as that's there, you stay here, because that's the cause of God's potency. It's something like this. It's mentioned in the story of Maharaj Prickett when he was asking so many questions. Sukadeva Goswami, has the pure soul come in contact with the world? He said, well, the initial desire is ours. The consequent desire is God. The initial desire is we want something. The consequent desire is God fulfills it. So we want some type of artificial position of self-centeredness. We want, God fulfills it. How does he fulfill it? He fulfills it by somehow having a potency and an energy that allows us to reflect our consciousness on the field of activity, which gives the illusion that we're self-centered. But the point is, that illusion is maintained as long as we have the consequent desire to be self-centered and some attachment to be the enjoyer and controller rather than the servant of God. So then it describes that somehow or other, however you do it, it has to be given up, and maybe it has to be fulfilled first, you know, or regulated first, or experience first, or renounce first. But however you do it, you have to give up those desires. And it described these paths that are mentioned in the Bhagavatam and their elaborate purports of it, of someone who experiences a certain desire, but in the appropriate way in which it can be satisfied and dropped. And it described it as even a process of, and that in the yogic path of people who are actually pious and put, you know, can undergo these type of regulations and prescribed duties and then mystic attainments, it would just elevate one to another level. Perhaps a more subtle level, where the desire can be experienced or filled. But ultimately, it would have to be given up. And ultimately, the most subtle conception of it, of false ego, that intrinsic desire, whatever the variety of it, is it the root cause, the ahankar, the desire to be self-centered and in control, that would have to be finally relinquished. So, according to the what I would call spiritual evolution and path and desire, one gets different destinations. So she was showing the context, even within this world, right, the evolution of your renunciation and therefore your level of consciousness would be would bestow upon one a certain level, a certain destination. And this is basically what it was about. There's so many different planetary systems and Mahaloka and Satyaloka and Brahmaloka. And it described it. So she's setting the context. And now, when you do actually become free from material desire, but also cultivate a positive desire to serve God, then you attain the realm of God, which is a place that facilitates that service. So that's it's muktir hitva
yata rupam. So mukti or liberation. Mukti or hit by yata, you give up. Mukti or hit by yata rupam, you give up the form that you are embracing that's external to the self. And sarupena vivastita. And then you become situated in swarup, your own intrinsic nature. So she's described now how that leads to the Lord's abode. It leads to the Lord's abode. And now that's what's going to be described here. For those who are who? For those who are niskama, who don't have material desires, don't have some objective other than their nature, their sarup, their essence as a servant of God. And meant focus on the pleasure of God in all the intention of their activities. They want to please God and they have no other desire. So now she's coming to and so she understands now, you know, she's kind of has some idea. So she really wants to know what is the nature of that place. So she's saying here, she's describing for those who she wants to understand, she knows something of the nature of the place. It's so high that even those desiring liberation don't qualify. Those who really don't want anything for this material world, don't want anything here in this world, they still don't qualify if they're not devotees. She's saying this place is so high. And then she wants to ask, well, what is the nature of that superlative place? And then she says, it is condensed bliss. And only the devotees who are free from selfish desire can, only the bhaktas, the bhante, reach this place quickly. The Sanskrit is interesting here. Vaikuntham dulabham muktai, it is difficult even for the muktai, the liberated souls. It's even difficult for the liberated souls. She says she's understanding this is special. And what is the nature of it? Sandrand Anand. Chit. Atmakam. It's consisting of Sandra, concentrated Anand. Concentrated bliss. And Chit. And the consciousness is just pure. And the people that attain it, the consciousness of the faith, are bhaktas, those who want to serve Krishna and are niskam. And this is Vaikuntha. A little technical problem here somehow. I don't know what happened here, but it will be solved in a second, I'm sure. Let the Krishna, the facilitator here. Oh, we got it. Okay. He got me an iPad. And I'm not a technical whiz, and I'm always about 5 or 10 years behind in terms of phones, computers, and things like that. But this is Yukta Vairagya because it really facilitates to have all my books and notes. And when I put notes in, they remain. So this is the place, and this is her inquiry. And So she's telling, this is beautiful, she's telling what she understands about the transcendent nature of Vaikuntha. She wants to understand the topmost of those. So now, in that desire, she first tells him what she understands. And these relationships are beautiful between really sincere students and qualified teachers. Because there's such a desire to really understand truth, not for the purpose of competition, envy, so I can be superior to other people because knowledge is power. But they really want to understand truth because they want to live by truth. And that's a great sacrifice, because truth does not coincide with your material desires. It's different than, of course, there is a truth where you can fulfill your material, right? But it's a challenge to you. It's a challenge. Truth is a challenge. Because truth, if you live by truth, it dictates your environment, it dictates your choices. And that challenges
Hare Krishna. It says all the organizers can be heard. Let me see if
I go.
Okay. Can I someone say hello and I'll continue?
Yeah.
Hi, Bo.
Okay, hi Bo. I'm trying to remember my last point, just give me a second. Yeah, it's just yeah, I was talking about the beauty and how she wants truth and she wants to live by truth and the challenges of that, because it's a challenge to our attachments. So there's descriptions in the now in the purports. There's going to be descriptions of that place which you attain when you are a devotee and when you are free from any selfish desires. So it first is from the second and then from the tenth cantos. It says, what to speak of the celestial demigods empowered to rule over mundane creatures? In that transcendental state, there is no supremacy of devastating time, which controls even the demigods themselves. It's hard to conceive, because from our frame of reference, everything is under time. But we could meditate for a second on the anxiety that time causes us, especially as it brings us closer and closer to death on the material platform, and what it takes away and how we're worried what time will do. And here in the spiritual world, there's a realm of substance, of things that just stay and never end. It's not like time takes your family, or time takes your relationships, or time takes your wealth. It is some platform, some reality that is not under time. And we can't conceptualize it very well in one sense, because for us, time is supreme. And Bhagavad Gita says, Krishna says, I am time, the controller of the worlds, and I've come to engage all living entities. Time is a manifestation of, it's actually Vishnu who is giving us our karma. Once karma is finished, there's no necessity for time. There's some kind of eternal reality. That, therefore, Krishna's pastimes are called Nityalila. It's happening always, and the same thing. And then it says, nor is there mode of material goodness, nor passion, nor ignorance, nor the false ego, nor the material causal ocean, nor the material nature. So there's no modes of nature, and there's no modes of nature because modes of nature are directly correlated with our desires based on ego. And that's how they're fulfilled, through different shapes and forms of both the subtle, gross body and the external environment. It's all just this incredible shades of desires. An environment that fulfills the desires, a mind that wants those desires, a body that can accomplish those desires, and there's not even any false ego. Because false ego is what? That conception, that it's a pure environment. The transcendentalists desire to avoid everything godless, for they know that supreme situation in which everything is related with Vishnu. So one who's spiritual, they see reality. And what is reality? Reality is God's energy. And there's God, and the energy is meant to serve God. And God can be the enjoyer because he's everything. And therefore, it's not selfish. The enjoyment of God is some kind of universal thing. Unless you cover yourself from it. Therefore, pure devotee is in absolute harmony with the Lord, does not create perplexities. He doesn't create any disharmony, any duality. He's focused on God. I don't know what word perplexities was translated, so it's hard. But worships the lotus feet of the Lord at every moment, take them as heart. That's the second canto, and more in the second canto. Very much satisfied with the penance of Lord Brahma, the personality of God, it was pleased to manifest his personal abode, Vaikuntha, the supreme planet above all others. So this actually question was asked. The Marge Cricket was asking so many questions because he wanted to have the frame of reference to understand the absolute reality. So the things he wasn't certain about. And he wanted his teacher to clarify them. The teacher in the proper relationship gives one the intellectual, emotional, and spiritual tools to understand things properly so that one could live by truth, which is one's benefit. So
Therefore, Marge Prickett asked the question, what is the nature, what's the Lord's form and transcendence? And to answer that question, Sukadeva Goswami told the story of the birth of Lord Brahma from the lotus navel of lotus flower growing from the navel of Vishnu, his kind of bewilderment about who he was and where he was, Krishna's instruction to him, tapa, he just heard the two syllables, that you should perform divine austerity. And then, by faith in that instruction and the proper consciousness, God, Krishna revealed to Brahma himself in his abode. And this is what it was like, that transcendental abode of the Lord is adored by all self-realized persons, free from all miseries and fear of illusory existence. In the spiritual world, there is neither the mode of passion, nor the mode of ignorance, nor a mixture of both, nor is there unadulterated goodness, nor the influence of time or maya. Only the pure devotees of the Lord who are worshipped both by the demigods and by the demons reside in the spiritual world as the Lord's associates. And then I'll do this and I'll stop for questions. And now the 10th canto. After deeply considering, the all-merciful Supreme Personality God at Hari revealed to the cowherd man his abode, which is beyond material darkness. Lord Krishna revealed the indestructible spiritual effulgence, which is unlimited, conscious, and eternal. Sages see that spiritual existence in trance when their consciousness is free from the modes of nature. False ego, somehow or other, creates the kind of a funnel that limits one's consciousness and the identification and the conception of one's identity to a particular material sphere, whether it's the body of an ant or the body of an elephant. So when sages, people who actually have pure consciousness and start to transcend the false ego, then they begin to see reality, and they begin to actually perceive spiritual existence. So basically what's happening here, and is going to happen for the next five verses, is Uttara, in a general way, is going to explain the transcendental existence of Vaikuntha. So she's laying out what she knows. But she really wants to know, and I guess what the Brihat Bhagavatamrita is ultimately about, is there gradations in Vaikuntha. The Lord's personal effulgence faintly reflects the spiritual atmosphere of Vaikuntha, which is the fullest manifestation of the absolute truth. Bear with me, one more paragraph. I don't see the audience, and I'm very, very hesitant to read, but it's a long purport, and then we'll just discuss. Having reestablished a personal relationship with the Lord, pure Vaishnavas attain Vaikuntha. Impersonalists, however, at best attain the Brahmajyoti effulgence, where they realize their eternal existence without knowing their relationship with the Lord or the ecstatic pleasure that comes from serving Him in that relationship. In other words, the Vaikuntha atmosphere is a superintensified version of the Brahmajyoti sky, and thus the life enjoyed by the Lord's devotee in Vaikuntha is much more wonderful than the comparatively insignificant pleasure of merging into the Brahmajyoti. So basically, it's continuing the theme, which is what comparative consciousness and the realm. So it's saying here by Quinta is when people are pure and their selflessness, purity is not only that they don't want material pleasure. They want to be completely surrendered to God. And this is what happens. This is what the realm is like. And naturally, when you give up the false ego, you give up all the things in connection with the false ego. And that's basically what bhakti is. Bhakti is a process that's changing our conception, our identity, our mood, our feeling, our identity. It's really focused on the false ego. And when you give that up, then you give up everything in relation to the false ego. And the false ego is subtle, and gross in the false ego is once you have that false conception, then there's the body, then there's the modes, then there's the times. Then there's the, you know, time and everything else that comes in along here. So here it says, give that up, and then none of these things that torture you and subjugate you and grind you exist. All that exists is sandrandana and chit, concentrated bliss. Concentrated ananda, which is and what is that ananda actually? When you give up the false ego and the false ego, you give up the false egotistical conception and you embrace your real identity, then, and you begin to function and desire to function as a servant of God, then you do what you were created for, which is to be a receptacle for the essence of the Lord's internal potency, which is his bhakti anand, is his pleasure, which is love and devotion. And that comes to one's heart. Okay, I'm going to stop here. Any questions? Just in case the problem here is it's muted, let me do one thing. Any questions?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Nanda Gulal, Hare Krishna.
Maharaj, in a wonderful class, I have one question. Just to get clear, we know Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita that we are the spiritual eternal. Now, when the world comes created, like Brahma was created, it gives me a little bit, can you clarify that?
Well, first of all, Brahma is a post, so that can be created. It's not that the soul that occupies that post is created. So, bhutva bhutva paliyate, the material world is created again and again. That's there for sure. But the soul is not created. The soul is eternal. A lot of times, even Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes, is hard to use the language of the world to describe spiritual events like, how the soul, the pure soul, became bound in matter, because or the origins of the good. Like, I mean, it's your buddha. We're eternally conditioned. I mean, we can't conceive of these things in relationship to time. It just doesn't. He said the dirt of words. So, I guess what I'm trying to say
don't
is
worry.
That. What's that? Who's that? So the in terms of created material things are created, are eternal. Doesn't ever say that spiritual things are created. And if it does say that spiritual things are created or there's a spiritual event, like the soul becoming encased in matter, it's just using a language so that we can have some concept of it. Okay?
Thank you, Mother. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. This is Gail.
Hi, Bill Gail.
You said something I wasn't really sure what the point was. It was when you were saying that Krishna isn't really selfish because, you know, his enjoyment is like universal. It's like all-pervading kind of thing.
Just saying, when something is done for God, God is inclusive of everything. And when something is done, we do something for ourselves, it's limited. It's not for everything. Because we're limited. God is Advayam Gyan. He's consciousness, which is inclusive of everything. So it's kind of like if the, you know, if the body demands food, the food is for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if the hand, you know, demands it, it's just for the hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that kind of concept.
Mm-hmm.
That, okay?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I it's really tricky. These are longer purports, so I'm going to just have to figure out. I'm probably have to kind of prepare more, because I don't think reading them will, I have my doubts how that works in this kind of form where I can't see the audience and I only speak to them on the same book after a week. But anyway, anybody else like to say hello or ask a question?
Maharaj?
Yeah, Mooney.
Thanks for another great class, Maharaj. I could follow up on Gail's question if that's okay. Excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Usually, and by the way, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, okay.
All right. Usually, when we hear examples like watering the root of the tree, it seems like there's two ways we can understand that. One is that if we kind of pull away from everything else and focus on God, then in some way those other things will be satisfied. Maybe we don't know how it'll happen, but somehow they'll be satisfied. Another way might be something like that when we're dealing with those other things, we have to find a way to serve God through that kind of through that interaction. And so I think like one seems to have a real jnana kind of component. The other may be more of a karma or tantric kind of component. And I was wondering, do you think one of them is the right way or are they either one can be appropriate at different times?
I really didn't understand the second.
Okay. So maybe an example. One might be something like this. Let's say you're dealing with your relatives or something. And one thing you might think is, well, look, I shouldn't spend my time trying to make them happy. I should kind of withdraw and give that time to satisfying God. And they'll be satisfied you know, I might not even understand how, but I trust that they'll be satisfied. Another might be something like, well, I'm dealing with these people, but when I do that, I have to do this in a way that this interaction satisfies God.
Okay, I understand your question. Now, what I would say now is it really depends on a circumstance and what the person's first duty is. You know what I'm saying? In certain circumstances, one may have to, it's obvious that it's either from the principle of Dharma or the direct inspiration of God, or, you know, somehow or other, God's will is manifest to you that you have to do something that is not overtly satisfying, for example, let's say one's family. You know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, okay, that would be one way. The other way would be is that at whatever your duty is particularly now, to emotionally and physically satisfy a partner, a family, appropriate to that relationship. Actually, that's God's will. To not do it is against God, because God's will has to do a lot with who we are, what our realizations are. You know, one man's food is another man's poison. So there may be a case where someone has a family or whatever the case is, and they're like completely evolved in spiritual life, you know, somehow or other, either by internal inspiration or whatever understanding, you know, they're supposed to, you know, dedicate themselves to the world, you know? And then another person who does that, it's not his duty, you know? And he's actually not acting according to God's will, you know? So I really think it's going to be, let me see if I can just take a deep breath and just say this. I think what I said initially is really the answer. It is what God's will plays out in different situations in different ways. Now, the question is, and I think we've discussed this before, and I think it may need further discussion, is whether when you do hit on God's will, right, is that somehow best to everyone?
Yeah. Yeah,
you know what I'm saying, and on the subtlest level, you know, let's say someone, for example, you know, they do get a calling to serve humanity. They actually did their family duties in an appropriate way, and they are getting older, you know, and somehow or other they have the karma and the ability, and there's the necessity to help humanity. Now, whether, even though their family will suffer, is it ultimately beneficial to them? Because if one serves Krishna, then, you know, the family becomes great.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, I think we discussed that before, and it was something I was still thinking about, you know. And a lot of times, it's interesting, and I think that's why it's good having Gail here, is as a speaker, I just don't repeat things, but I put things together and come up with some almost original ideas sometimes, you know, based on either philosophical realization or, you know, reconciling different points. So there's sometimes creativity in my presentation, you know. You know, beyond just kind of like quoting a particular Shastra verse. And there's obviously a lot of leeway for that because, you know, there's the philosophy, the application of it in a myriad of so many circumstances, you know. But it's good to have like a check, you know what I'm saying? And to kind of, you know, because, you know, you're reconciling things. You're trying to, you know. Yeah, but anyway, that's what I have to say.
Well, Mark, I don't know if it's like maybe the muting thing, but I did hear you, but there's like a lot of echo.
There's a lot of echo. Oh, let me try one more thing. Mooney, can you unmute yourself?
Yeah, I can. Thanks, Marsh. I think Marsh, if I understood what you were saying then, is that, you know, it's not like one way of understanding that is the only way, but that context will determine what's the appropriate way to carry out this understanding.
The question is the appropriate way, somehow or other, on the subtlest level, you know, harmless or at least beneficial? You know what I'm saying? Like in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, Arjuna kills his relatives on the other side, but it was the appropriate thing, you know, because of the war and Krishna's order and everything else. So somehow, you know, they get liberated or, you know. But are there other circumstances where, you know, on an ultimate sense, and I would say the ultimate sense is for the soul and bringing the soul back to Godhead, you know, bringing the soul to a greater level of awareness, is, you know, serving God ever, you know, against that interest anywhere, you know?
Yeah. Well, wasn't there the story of Maharaj Priyavrata where he kind of, I forget, it's been a long time since I've read that, but if I remember correctly, he didn't want to get involved in becoming like a king or some kind of leader because he was happy with this meditative life. And maybe it was better for the world that he did that, but I'm not sure if it was better for his own meditation. If I remember, that was part of the dynamic of that story. Am I remembering that?
Just liked it. Read it recently.
Yeah.
You know, that was the thing that was really weighing on me there. And I was wondering if at the end of the story that was all reconciled, you know?
Yeah.
You know, but that's another example. That's, it believes God's will is best to everyone else except yourself, you know?
But then what does it mean best then? I feel like then there's a confusion about what we mean by best, right? It's like there's that, like the story that Srila Rupa Goswami quotes of the person who is fanning Krishna, and because of experiencing bhava, they weren't doing it well. And they said, well, to hell with my ecstasy. I just want to do my service properly. I mean, that's got to be the highest understanding, right? And if that's the highest understanding.
What I'm saying is best would mean spiritually, you know, for his consciousness, you know what I'm saying? He did what God wanted, and actually, it was like Lord Brahma, Narada Muni, that he did what God wanted, you know what I'm saying? Now, what could he have been disadvantaged in his spiritual life by doing that? It would disturb me, or at least it wouldn't fit my present frame of reference, right? That by following, you know, the acharyas, and the, you know, he actually sacrificed his life. If there wasn't some kind of, you know, greater benefit for doing that, than, you know, staying in the ashram and meditating, you know. So what I'm saying I'm trying to really get down to best is best. You know what is best? Best is awareness.
Yeah.
You know, higher level of awareness. You know, if he fell more in ignorance, I mean, temporarily, it's by the story, it does seem that he did, you know.
Yeah.
But ultimately, is that what happened? And I'd really like to study that story. I'm going to actually do it and see if at the end, if there is something mentioned. And if it's not, then I would like to approach someone and have that reconciled. You know what I'm saying? Like go to a prophet in Vrindavan. You know, how can you follow God, right? And follow the direction of your guru, and the result is you know, you're covered for 3 million years, you know? So I like to see that, and that's the kind of consistency that I was looking for in the other way, you know? Can your service to God be harmful to someone else, you know, by doing dharma? Can it be harmful to someone else, ultimately? Or is there some transcendental system, you know, something that reconciles it on a higher level, you know.
I'm really grateful that you brought this back up, because I thought that maybe this is one of those things we talk about and then it just fades into the oblivion because other things come up. And I appreciate that. I think, Marish, one way in which, and by the way, let me know if we're going too long or something, but it seems, Marish,
I get good feedback, and people that don't, they, anyway,
I get the impression, sometimes I think, Marish, that we may obscure this issue because we treat the only instance of Dharma as somehow like choosing to give yourself to God or something. But I think if we start from like ordinary cases of morality, at least it seems like there's definitely cases where you do what's right, and it's still not necessarily going to be perfect for everybody. And just so, for example, I think I have a special moral obligation to take good care of my daughters and show and kind of give them little gifts from time to time to show them that they're loved. And yet, if I do that, that means something that I can't give to, that's just a certain amount of money or time that I can't give, let's say, to help the poor, which is we have a general obligation to help those who are suffering. To me, it's just clear. There's just ways in which, in ordinary cases of morality, it seems like there's serious conflicts where you can do what's right, but it doesn't mean that everyone's going to benefit.
If not benefit, but would someone be harmed?
Well, to the degree that someone's not going to get what they need, let's say, to be, nourished, then it's going to be harder for them to practice Dharma or whatever, you know. So that's one example. But here's another one. And this is maybe more in line with sadhana and practice. You know, you said that what's best is the kind of, I forget exactly how you put it, but something like developing your spiritual consciousness more deeply. That's kind of what we use as our indicator of what's the best thing to do. But I think what's going on in a lot of the problems like Maharaj Priyavrata is that whose spiritual consciousness, right? Like if one person can delay their own spiritual advancement so that 500 other people's spiritual advancement benefits, maybe that would be the right thing. I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying it seems to me that that's what happened in that story, if I remember it correctly. And
I'd like to see that. Really, that's what happened. That's what I question. That's what happened.
Yeah. It seems
somehow or other, he loses out, by making a sacrifice like that for others, They may, who knows how karma works, or people's spiritual evolution works. God can arrange it so that that person who does that, he's actually getting a component of something that he actually needed that maybe he didn't get when he was in the meditation.
Right.
Maybe on the long run, that was maybe, God's grace that he got a desire fulfilled that maybe wouldn't have been worked out the other way. Or got a realization that impelled him in a stronger way, I still have, go ahead.
I appreciate your point. Basically, there's only two other things that came to mind, but they're not directly on this point. One is going back to this kind of the thing that started this discussion, is watering the root of the tree to pull away from everything else and focus on the root, or is it to somehow or other, when you're dealing with everything else, do it mindful of the root or whatever? It seems to me that even if you want to do the latter, which would be something like karma yoga or maybe a kind of bhakti, seeing the world through bhakti, you still need to have some times of your life where you do just focus on the root to have the capacity to look for the root, so to speak, when you're out in the world. That might have been a little long-winded, but what I'm getting at is, even if your dharma, or even if the right thing is not just to pull away from the other relationships, I think it's pretty clear that you won't have the strength or the insight to find God in those relationships unless you do regularly take some time to just focus on your relationship with God in a kind of private way. Does that make sense to you?
It does, but I more look at watering the root by doing what one is supposed to rather than just, you know, sadhana or the other, you know.
Okay.
But I understand you're taking it also. But I was looking at more of that example of watering the root is just doing what you should be doing. And not watering the root is doing something that you're not, which could be some kind of focused individual thing. But if it's connected to God, I would look at that as watering the root. But, okay.
Okay.
All right, I guess it's a little bit late at night, and we're having great time in the morning here with sadhana bhakti in Vrindavan. And it's very quiet here now. And tomorrow, I'll go to Govardhan, visit Keshava Bharti Maharaj. He hasn't been here for a while. Stay over and do a little program. And then, really nice, but tomorrow we'll go for lunch. Should be out at Govardhan, who's Prabhupada's, servant to so many years. So, anyway, things like that going on. And then on Wednesday, I know this shopkeeper in Vrindavan. He's very, very nice, And he lived in this temple, the family with the monks of this temple. And he once brought me in and showed me his library that he donated to the Vrindavan Research Institute. But he's in line from the disciples of Srinivas Kaviraj, who claims to have the original Madhyasula. So we're going to take darshan of it. Anyway, anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Kumar from Dallas.
Hare Krishna, Kumar. Thanks.
Hare Krishna,
you feel well. Thank you. Good.
And Maharaj, if you have just a minute, I just have a quick clarification. You gave an interesting analogy about water and ice, that we are basic ingredient needs to be water. And I said it's really difficult to be ice, or is it? I mean, we are in kind of an altered state because we have focus on different things where we should be focusing on God. So we have attachment to different things. So we are in state of ice. So is it easy for us to switch back to water?
Well,
or you said
it's certainly not easy to be the controller and the enjoyer, but we're attached to it. And we're conditioned by it. That's no doubt. But ultimately, if we actually surrendered to Krishna, it would be much easier. And, analogies hold so far. But in the general case, water just stays as water. I mean, sometimes, water can get really cold. But the general thing is that water stays liquid. And it's an effort to get it ice, And you have to do something to keep it ice, and you have to, get a certain temperature and maintain that temperature. Of course, the North Pole, that may be like this, it's the material world. The environment is such that it's easy to stay ice or something. Okay, I have to go now, but thanks, Kumar.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Anybody else? Final one or two people say hello.
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. This is Allegra in Princeton.
Who is this?
Allegra in Princeton.
Say it again slowly.
Allegra from Princeton.
Oh, Allegro. Thank you. So nice from you. Great. And thank you for that letter the last time, too. Wonderful. Good. It's nice that I hear voices of different people, too. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, we'll finish now. You're all welcome. Please come to Vrindavan. It's a great place.
Pancha Kalpa Trubhyas Chakra Pasindhu Bhyabhya Chapatitana Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo.